Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. This is our third case for set for oral arguments. This is case number A20-0098, Diversified Manufacturing Corp versus MBKV LLC. Council, for appellants, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. Please, when you begin, state your name for the record and the party you're representing. There is a timer in one of the windows that will indicate how much time you have left. If we should have any technical difficulties, which we have in the past, we will certainly make adjustments to make sure that we have enough time to hear your oral arguments. And to that end, Mr. James, can you please speak up again? Just, I want to confirm that we can hear you.
I'm here, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kuhn, if you want to unmute, just check to make sure we can hear you as well.
I can hear you just fine, Your Honor.
Okay, perfect. So, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. You will have 15 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am attorney Stephen Kuhn, C-O-O-N, on behalf of appellate MBKV LLC. Your Honor, this appeal is from a bench trial in Washington County on a breach of contract case in which the court awarded the plaintiff the full measure of its requested damages, approximately $104,000, along with prejudgment interest, and it subsequently added attorney's fees and cost. Appellate's contention on appeal is that the trial court made several errors of law or findings that were not supported by the weight of the evidence. The two primary sources of contention in the trial and the judge's decision were one, the issue of a plaintiff not providing the formula in connection with the products. And two, the second issue was that one of the two products delivered by a respondent failed an independent safety.
Mr. Kuhn, test. I was on that, dealing with the formula and the product. I just want to make sure. I assume in looking at the contract, the integration clause, it does reference the respective invoices and corresponding terms supplied by DMC. Is it your position that either of those invoices or the corresponding terms supplied by DMC envision an obligation to provide those formulas?
There is nothing in anything in writing from DMC that ever agreed to provide those formulas. On that point, Your Honor, I think the issue is the argument of respondent is that the Alpha Real Estate case and other cases like it prevent the parole evidence rule to apply to this case because there is a merger clause in the contract. And I would argue.
Well, I would certainly agree with you that the lease in the Alpha Real Estate case was a lot longer than this one-page document. But at the end of the day, that doesn't make an integration clause invalid, does it?
It doesn't make it invalid. But what all those cases stand for is that you cannot, it invalidates any prior oral promises or agreements that were done before you have the written contract with the integration clause. In this case, we are not trying to enforce any promises or alleged oral agreements that were made before the 2015 contract was entered into. Rather, we are focused on subsequent promises and representations or agreements that were made after that, but before subsequent orders were placed and delivered.
And then how do you, go ahead, Judge Reyes, no, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Connolly. I'll wait.
No, I think you were about to ask the exact same question I was about to ask.
Yeah, I'm a little confused by that then. That doesn't seem to be the argument that you're making in the briefs and before the district court. It seemed like you wanted to get evidence to, parole evidence to add to the contract between the parties.
Well, it's not that we were trying to modify the 2015 contract in and of itself. I mean, it's undisputed that contract is simply silent as to the issue of intellectual property. We're simply saying that there were subsequent oral agreements that are not referenced in the 2015 contract, that if the appellant purchased a certain amount of products, that then they would be entitled to ownership of the intellectual property associated with what's called the mix and match formula.
Okay, but let me stop you there because I'm still very confused here, because you have that initial agreement. It talks about payments that need to be made for product that is provided, correct?
Sure.
Yes. And it says nothing about ownership of the formula. So under the IP laws, that formula is owned by the party that creates it, which in this case would be respondents, correct?
Correct. And if all we had was the 2015 contract, the law would say that that is correct, that even though it doesn't address the issue of ownership of the formulas, the law would imply that it was owned by respondent. I agree with that.
Okay, so if you want to get that formula, you would need to have a new contract, either a new contract entered into or a modification of the existing contract to show that for in return for getting that formula, that appellants would then be providing something of value over and above the original agreement where payments had already been agreed to be made. In other words, there needed to be some type of agreement, there needed to be consideration. And so it sounds to me like now you're arguing there was a new agreement that's in place and you wanted to somehow get that introduced into evidence. I'm really struggling here with your argument.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit confused as to what you're asking, Your Honor, but to explain it the best I can is the 2015 contract, while it sort of dictates terms of the party's relationship, it doesn't obligate appellant to buy anything. I mean, it's just a contract that would govern any future agreements by the parties. So the appellant opted to subsequently make three separate orders. And the idea would be that the consideration for the final order of 50,000 units was that respondent agreed to provide the intellectual property in connection with that order, that they didn't have any obligation to otherwise place and pay for. So I believe parole evidence is applicable to that issue of the party's agreement on providing the formula prior to the final of the three orders being placed, which is at issue here and it's undisputed that it was not, in fact, provided, and it's undisputed that appellant had to pay a different firm $6,000 to reverse engineer that formula for it. Turning to the issue of warranty, in the 2015 contract, there is an express warranty of the product will conform as to quality, which under the UCC would be probably considered a warranty of merchantability. And on respondent's website, they represent that all products will undergo stability testing and a full safety assessment. The issue here is that—
Well, is that different from whether QVC is gonna buy it?
Well,
I mean, yes, no. I mean, I assume, well, you correct me if I'm wrong, that these items did not live up to QVC standards, but there's no suggestion that, you know, these were poisonous or, you know, not toothpaste or anything, right?
Where there's no suggestion that the products in and of themselves didn't meet the specifications that appellate had requested. So on their face, as far as their appearance and everything else that you can just observe, they fully were conforming. It comes down to the underlying issue of what is the industry standard as far as quality and safety.
And there were two experts on that, and the district court rejected your expert. And are you saying that was error too?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
How?
The error is the contract was drafted by respondent. They represented that they did the testing. There's no disclosure by respondent that they do not do one of the two tests that are recommended by the FDA for over-the-counter cosmetic oral care products. The two tests recommended by the FDA are the contamination test, which is what respondent did, and the preservative effectiveness.
But presumably, test. Mr. Kuhn, if that was really important to you, well, I mean, you could have had an addendum to the contract that says, oh, and by the way, if this doesn't meet QVC standards, you know, no payment, right? I mean, because that's the problem I'm having. It sounds like you assumed they would meet QVC standards, but the evidence doesn't suggest you told that to Mr. James's client, and it doesn't seem to appear that that was a material term of the, well, it's totally silent. And so well, presumably you would address that in the contract. And that, I guess that's the problem I think the district court had and, you know, rejected. And so I guess I just want to make sure I understand what did the district court get wrong in this court trial?
I think the district court got wrong as far as who had the burden to prove what industry testing was required, if it was something different than what the FDA recommended. The testimony of appellant's expert was, this is what the two things are the FDA recommended. It's not required by an FDA regulation per se, but it's recommended, and it's not a unique QVC test. If this was something that was only required by QVC and that was not discussed beforehand, appellant would clearly lose. But the QVC test was simply their own version of that, what is recommended by the FDA and what is the same more or less protocol of all other major retailers. And that was undisputed. So
I'm not so sure about that, Mr. Kuhn, because I think your argument had been that the QVC, the argument between the experts was that the QVC standard is not an industry standard, and the agreement requires industry guidelines on quality levels. And so the question I have is QVC, is that the industry guideline or industry standard on quality levels?
I think that the QVC test is consistent with the industry standard based on FDA recommendations. Respondents put forth no evidence that there is a industry standard or industry guidelines that only recommends the contamination test and not the preservative effectiveness test. And again, their contract that they drafted gives the impression that they are doing full testing. Their website gives the impression they're doing full testing. I don't think it's a thing where you can expect the customer to be able to dictate what testing specifically needs to be done when they're holding themselves out as being in this industry and that they're doing the full safety testing protocol.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhn. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. James, you have 15 minutes. You state your name for the record and the party you're representing. With that, you may proceed.
Can you hear me, Your Honor? John C. James.
Yes, we can.
Appearing for the plaintiff in the original trial, respondent, and the appeal herein, Diversified Manufacturing Corporation. Your Honor, there's two main issues on appeal here. Breach of contract, breach of warranty. There's some other sub-issues, but those are the primary issues. Although the contract doesn't specifically state so, this is a UCC case in a sense. Page 27 of the respondent's brief addresses the issue of breach of contract cases and UCC cases. And I believe we cite a couple of cases that indicate that the contract principle of performance being excused by one party or the other party breaches first is wholly inapplicable to this kind of dispute. In this case, my client did everything in accordance with the contract and in accordance with two prior orders that the appellate had placed. The contract was a one-page contract of record that indicated 30 days payment term. The appellate accepted the goods, the whole order. Payment was due in 30 days, which would have been approximately July 1st, 2017, and they didn't pay. And after that point, they raised the breach of contract issue, which is namely that, quote, you promised to give us the formulation, which is actually my client's contribution. The appellate also provided initial instructions, so it's a fairly involved factual situation, which the trial court made extensive findings on. They raised that after accepting the goods. They never rejected the goods. Now, 9 months later, the breach of warranty issue arose. Actually, my client was not given notice till his deposition, which was approximately a year later, that this claim that the goods were non-performing due to failing a preservative efficacy test. The court held that appellate had waived their right to the only remedy under the contract, which was reworking. The appellates could have approached the respondent and said, your product's not conforming, rework is the term that's used in the contract towards the bottom, which means basically open the product, add more sodium benzoate, and recap the product, and it, quote, would have been reworked, which was the sole remedy under the contract. They chose not to do that. Both of these issues I spoke of involved conflicting testimony from witnesses. This was a bench trial where there were six witnesses, two of which were experts. The trial court had a chance to observe their demeanor and made detailed findings. And not only did the court apply the law, she also indicated that she was finding facts, and then in the alternative, the respondents or the appellate would not prevail, even if she did, even if the parole evidence were allowed in that case, in the breach of contract issue. The breach of warranty issue turned upon the testimony of the two competing experts, and the court found that there wasn't an industry standard and that the contract was not breached in this situation. I don't know if the fact that, if the time factor played a role in that, but the appellate didn't, it was found the appellate didn't have an excuse for non-payment. The appellates didn't pay, they've never paid what they're seeking to establish through the trial is offset, basically none of which the trial courts granted. After a bench trial, the trial court is to be given, its findings of fact are to be given great deference and not set aside unless clearly erroneous. The issue of the parole evidence is a question of law. And I would just state that the case now, the appellate cited some earlier cases that involved exceptions to the parole evidence rule. I would say since 2003, the Alpha Real Estate case by the Minnesota Supreme Court is kind of the seminal authority on merger clauses and exceptions to the parole evidence rule. And I would argue that such a policy encourages agreements to be in writing. Written contracts avoid disputes, or they're supposed to avoid disputes, such as the case herein. And I don't think the parole evidence rule stands for the proposition that matters surrounding the prime contract are not addressed in the prime contract. Can't be dealt with by the parties, just that you cannot contradict the main written contract with parole evidence. Terms that are consistent with the main contract can be testified to, and that's not the case herein. Both there, or at least the breach of contract issue is a direct conflict and does not, it directly contradicts the contract. If there is to be a oral modification of a written contract, I think the case law site states that there needs to be clear and convincing evidence. The trial court in this case found the proof wanting. Some of the other exceptions they've cited, condition precedent, for example, that has more to do with formation issues. Nobody's disputing exhibit one from the trial, the one-page contract in this case. Nobody's disputing that that's the written instrument in this case. They're merely trying to say that they can add additional terms, or the additional terms were added to it. The trial court found in the negative that that wasn't the case. They also argue fraudulent inducement, that they reasonably relied on the principle of my client as representations that he would give them the formula. Well, the court determined the facts differently, but even if they would have, you know, found that, proponents of allowing in extrinsic or parole evidence to nullify the main agreement will always claim this, and that kind of defeats the whole purpose of the rule, that you want certainty, or as much certainty as you can have in written contracts. Does the court have any questions in the last 5 minutes?
We do not. And if you are done, Mr. James, then we will move back to Mr. Kuhn for rebuttal.
I think I'm done at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. James. And we'll just set the clock for the rebuttal. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Kuhn.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to quickly address the trial court's two sort of in the alternative findings. One was that she decided that parole evidence did not apply to modify the party's agreement concerning ownership of the formula, but made an alternative finding saying even if it did, appellates would not meet their burden. I think the court made a clear error in its findings in that regard, because the trial court order specifically says that the testimony of appellate was that they admitted that they did not request the formula until after delivery of the product, when in fact the testimony of Mr. Alan Desai was that they had requested it numerous times. And then exhibits 108 and 109, which 109 is contains the notes of a phone call prior to the final order being placed in April 2017. And exhibit 108 is the email that was sent contemporaneously with the order being placed, in which in both cases there's references to promises by respondent to provide those formulas in connection with that order. Secondly, on the courts also found as a matter of law that respondent did not breach its warranty and they were conforming goods. But found in the alternative, even if that was not the case, appellate's sole remedy was to have respondent rework the product, and it waived that. I believe that also was clearly erroneous, because in this case, the reason why appellant had to have independent testing done of the products were respondent only supplied a one-page document basically certifying that the products were tested and they passed, which was unacceptable to QVC because they couldn't even tell what tests exactly were done. Respondents didn't provide any underlying testing. So then they had to do the independent testing to show that in fact passed the test, and this took time. And by the time they got those results back of the testing, which showed one of the two products failed, we were already months into this lawsuit thereafter through counsel that those reports were provided to respondent, and respondent never did anything. So to try to say that appellant waived its only remedy under the contract to have it reworked, I think is ridiculous when we're in the middle of a lawsuit. They've raised the affirmative defense of non-conforming goods. They've now, during the course of the lawsuit, provide these expert reports that it failed the test, and respondents certainly never offered to rework the product, and they never even retested them or did anything. So I don't think you can argue from that that appellant waived any rights concerning the issue of the non-conforming goods under the contractual warranty. With that, I would yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you both, counsel. Thank you for your oral arguments and your written submissions. We will be issuing an order within the statutory time frame. That is